From Washington, this is VOA News. Cuba releases U.S. citizen Alan Gross from prison, and Pakistani Army chief visits Kabul after school attack. I'm Bob Doty, reporting from Washington. A senior U.S. administration official says Cuba has released U.S. citizen Alan Gross after holding him for 5 years in a Cuban prison. The official said Gross had been released on humanitarian grounds. U.S. officials say three Cubans jailed in the United States also have been released. The news came as officials said that President Barack Obama is to announce a major shift in U.S. policy towards the communist nation. You can listen to the president speak at 17 hours UTC here on VOA. Pakistan's army chief visited Kabul Wednesday for talks with Afghan President Ashraf Ghani on the security situation along their country's border, a day after Taliban militants killed 132 children at a Pakistani school. Mr. Ghani assured Pakistani General Rahil Sharif that militants will not be able to use Afghan soil to launch terrorist attacks against Pakistan, and any sign of this will be eliminated. General Sharif, who was accompanied by the head of Pakistan's intelligence agency, Rizwan Akhtar, met separately in Kabul with U.S. General John Campbell, who heads NATO forces in Afghanistan. A European court has ruled Palestinian militant group Hamas must be removed from an EU list of designated terror groups. The General Court of the European Union says the European Union improperly included Hamas on the basis of information it got from the media and the Internet. Hamas Deputy Chief Musa Abu Marzouk welcomed the decision. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu denounced Hamas as a murderous terrorist organization with a stated goal of destroying Israel. This is VOA News. The New York premiere of a film about a fictional plot to assassinate North Korea leader Kim Jong-un has been canceled following threats by a shadowy hacker group. The so-called Guardians of Peace on Tuesday released a statement promising a bitter fate to those who see the interview, which is set to be released nationwide on Christmas Day. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security says it is analyzing the message, but insisted there is no credible intelligence to indicate an active plot against movie theaters. Australia's Prime Minister is promising an investigation into how a deranged Iranian-born man with a history of violence and extremism was allowed to carry out this week's deadly cafe attack. Man Haran Monis on Monday stormed the Lindt Chocolate Cafe in downtown Sydney, taking 17 hostages. The 50-year-old suspect, along with two hostages, were killed when police commandos raided the cafe. Monis was well known to Australian authorities. He had been freed on bail after being charged as an accessory to the murder of his ex-wife. On Wednesday, Prime Minister Tony Abbott said at a news conference,
"We do need to know why the perpetrator of this horrible outrage got permanent residency. We do need to know how he could have been on welfare for so many years. We do need to know what this individual was doing with a gun license. We particularly need to know how someone with such a long record of violence, such a long record of mental instability, was out on bail."
Abbott said Monis seems to have fallen off an Australian terrorist watch list back in about 2009. The value of the Russian ruble improved slightly Wednesday after Moscow said it will intervene further to support the troubled currency. The rebound came after Russia's finance ministry announced it will sell foreign currency from its reserves for as long as needed to stabilize the ruble, which it said is extremely undervalued. By around midday Wednesday in the Russian capital, the value of the ruble was up about 5%, trading at about 64 rubles per dollar. U.S. President Barack Obama has signed a $1.1 trillion bill that will fund nearly every federal government agency through next September. The only exception in the bill signed Tuesday is for the Department of Homeland Security, which will run out of funding at the end of February. Republican leaders limited funding for the agency so they can again try to force the president to reverse his executive order that removes the threat of deportation for millions of undocumented immigrants. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yigis Wuhib, and coming up this hour on African News Tonight.
Ebola continues to attack Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone on several fronts. While infections and deaths rise, the disease is posing a greater threat to food security. UN agencies warn that more than 1 million people could be food insecure by March unless action is taken now.
That's VOA's Jody Kapawa reporting. Details coming up.
Also, Kenya pressures South Sudan's political leaders to agree on a peace deal.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Ebola continues to attack Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone on several fronts. While infections and deaths rise, the disease is posing a greater threat to food security. UN agencies warn that more than 1 million people could be food insecure by March unless action is taken now. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The UN Food and Agriculture Organization, World Food Program, and the governments of the three countries have just surveyed the food security situation. A joint statement calls for drastically improved access to food, as well as measures to safeguard both crop and livestock production. Alexander Jones is the chief of FAO's Donor Relations and Resource Mobilization.
Well, obviously, the most urgent priority of FAO and all of our UN partners is to stop the epidemic and the loss of life that's caused by it. But we also need to keep in mind that there is a need to reduce the food security impacts of this crisis, which are equally challenging. This is having both direct and indirect impacts on millions of people in the three main affected countries in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone.
The UN agencies say access to food has been blocked by border closings, quarantines, hunting bans, and transport restrictions. Livelihoods have been disrupted, and food markets have been closed for long periods. Jones says the harvesting and processing of food has either slowed or stopped in some places.
These are countries, of course, which have a very large rural agricultural sector. It's taking labor force away from these areas. Normally during harvest and other critical agricultural seasons, there's a large inflow of population from other areas. And obviously this is not happening with all the quarantines and movement limitations placed on them. So there's an absolute lack of labor force in this area.
Farm workers no longer have the salaries they did prior to the outbreak. Their lack of spending is also contributing to an economic slowdown in the countries. The FAO's Jones says farmers that are able to produce some crops are having a tough time selling them.
So we're seeing that prices in production areas are dropping and they're rising in consumption areas. So typically rural areas have less income with which to buy things they need, and urban areas are seeing price increases.
Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone have been forced to import more food and are not able to export crops to neighboring countries as they have in the past. The FAO and the Africa Solidarity Trust Fund have donated more than $3 million to food security efforts, but officials say millions of dollars more will be needed. Meanwhile, the World Food Program's Emergency Response Coordinator, Denise Brown, describes the Ebola outbreak as a wake-up call for the world. She says, while working with partners to make things better, we must be prepared for them to get worse. To make things better, UN agencies are trying to reestablish the farm system in the three countries. This includes distribution of seeds and fertilizer, better agricultural methods to help compensate for the labor shortages, and cash transfers or vouchers to allow people to buy food and help stimulate markets. Currently, it's estimated 520,000 people are severely food insecure in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. UN officials say without urgent action, that number could double by March. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Sierra Leone health officials today began a door-to-door search of homes in and around the capital Freetown for people infected with the Ebola virus. President Ernest Bai Koroma launched the 14-day Operation Western Area Surge in a national broadcast this morning. He said inspectors will be accompanied by security officers to ensure cooperation in neighborhoods being canvassed. Mr. Bai Koroma said not to hide the sick. He promised that ambulances, testing labs, and treatment beds will be available for all those with Ebola symptoms. Sierra Leone has already banned Sunday trading, travel between districts, and public celebrations of Christmas and New Year's to reduce transmission of the virus. An estimated 7,000 have died of Ebola in affected countries in the past 9 months. However, infection rates have stabilized in neighboring Guinea and Liberia, and numbers in the west of Sierra Leone continue to rise. In spite of the recent spike in Sierra Leone, a U.S. expert on the epidemic predicts a drop in infections there within weeks. Dr. Tom Frieden of the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention told reporters in Freetown that the weekly rise in cases in Freetown in recent weeks is similar to numbers in Monrovia 2 months ago. He said Sierra Leone can now take advantage of Liberia's experience to effectively contain the spread of the virus.
Also, the Ebola virus has affected sports in other African countries. Morocco declined to host the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations tournament, so the organizers accepted an invitation from Equatorial Guinea. However, the 2012 Woman Footballer of the Year, Genoveva Anoma, who was from Equatorial Guinea, says the tournament should be canceled for the good of humanity and of her country. Equatorial Guinea's Deputy Sports Minister, Ruslan Obiang Nsu, said the government is confident that it can manage the games and prevent Ebola infections in the country. An American doctor recently recovered from the Ebola virus will return to work at the Monrovia Hospital where he contracted the virus. Dr. Richard Sakura from Massachusetts General Hospital said he will return to Elwha Hospital for a 4-week tour as a volunteer doctor. The hospital is a clinic outside Monrovia that was founded by SIM, a charity in North Carolina. Medical staff of the Boston Hospital have volunteered at Elwha for 20 years.
East African nations are expecting South Sudan's refugee numbers to rise drastically in the coming year as more people flee violence and a deepening humanitarian crisis in the country. VOA's Cape Jasro reports Kenya's top diplomat also says her country will keep pressure on South Sudan's political leaders to agree on a peace deal.
Humanitarian agencies say the number of South Sudanese seeking refuge in neighboring countries could rise to 821,000 people next year if a lasting peace is not achieved soon. The expected upsurge would add to more than 500,000 South Sudanese refugees already living in Ethiopia, Kenya, Sudan, and Uganda. United Nations agencies and NGOs working on the crisis launched an appeal Wednesday for more than $800 million to fund the refugee response in the host countries. The crisis in South Sudan began a year ago when a political dispute between the president and his deputy spiraled into an inter-ethnic conflict that's divided factions of the ruling party against one another. Negotiators from the warring sides are scheduled to meet in Addis Ababa this week to continue to work on a peace deal. The process has been uninspiring, as at least 4 past ceasefire agreements have all been violated. Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Foreign Affairs, Amina Mohamed, speaking to reporters after the launch of the refugee response plan in Nairobi, said Kenya continues to have faith in the process.
So at the political level, we're doing everything that we can. And I can tell you that we've made a lot of progress, but we're not there yet. We've made progress on all the issues except for issues that relate to security and the governance structure.
Kenya is part of the IGAD group of nations mediating the talks. The group has threatened sanctions against South Sudan leaders from both sides of the conflict if they cannot abide by a lasting ceasefire deal. Meantime, Kenya is also considering a new security bill that would, among other things, cap the number of refugees allowed in Kenya at 150,000. Mohamed said she did not think the bill will have any effect on refugees in the country or the appeal for funding.
The bill is not yet through. It's just gone through its first reading in Parliament. It's still under active consideration and discussion. I don't think it has any bearing at all on the request that we've made to the international community today to support the refugees that are already in Kenya.
Kenya currently hosts more than 500,000 refugees, most of them from neighboring Somalia. Gabe Joslo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Gabe. Well, there is a lot to be angry about in South Sudan, especially among the young and far better educated generation. Youth feel alienated by the leaders who have waged a war for power at the expense of people just 2 years after independence. But to date, there has been little public protest. Analysts say that the tens of thousands of refugees and jobless have no time for taking to the streets. Their main concern is to make ends meet. As Benno Muchler reports from Juba, there is possibly another explanation. South Sudan is a military state that suppresses opposition.
Michael Dengadwell is a refugee. He is one of about 50,000 who have sought safe haven from the fighting at a United Nations site near Bentiu, a strategic town near some of South Sudan's most important oil fields. It has changed hands many times during the year-old conflict. On a recent morning, the 26-year-old primary school teacher recounted his difficult experience.
Even me, I come here through difficulties. I spent about 5 days in the bush without drinking any water. I taste also even the urine. I drink the urine.
Deng has a lot to be angry about. He came here almost exactly 1 year ago, just about when war broke out. Since then, he says he has led a life that seems no better than that of an animal. Flies swarmed around his head while he talks, sitting in a heated mud hut covered with plastic sheets. The UN camp stands on a barren field with no escape from the South Sudanese sun. Food, water, and electricity are scarce. But the worst part, people say, is having nothing to do and feeling imprisoned because outside the camp it's too dangerous. Asked why no one protests against their elected leaders who are responsible for this situation, Deng had this to say.
The problem is that Africa, and I can say Africa in general, is different from Europe, is different from USA, is different from other continents. In South Sudan here, we say that South Sudan, we use democratic system. And that one, it remains in the books. If you make a protest now, you can be killed.
Soldiers and guns are omnipresent. The government is mostly made up of former guerrillas, with no room for outsiders who did not physically fight for independence that became reality 3 years ago. The Sudan People's Liberation Movement Party rules the country with an iron fist. In the history of many countries, it was often a student movement that began a struggle for change. But following ethnic clashes between students at Juba University 2 years ago, the school administration banned student associations. Outside the university, medical student David Tut Ali said they fear to openly speak their minds.
And it's very difficult to express our feelings. They just talk of freedom, of which freedom is not in place, it is not in action.
Many students shared his opinion but feared sharing their names because of South Sudan's security service. After three more student interviews, a man in plain clothes approached, insisted in Arabic to follow him to a police station, and took my journalistic accreditation. I asked a nearby soldier to be my translator and follow me as a backup. After a 5-minute walk, the plainclothes officer relented and then told me to report to him the next day. Deng Atuay Mawir, one of South Sudan's most outspoken government critics, knows all too well the risks for activists. As the head of the South Sudan Civil Society Alliance, he has challenged the government of President Salva Kiir and his former deputy-turned-rebel Riek Machar many times. 2 years ago, he was kidnapped. And just a few weeks ago, he says an unknown gunman almost killed him on the street.
I start the car, somebody came out on the other right on the side, and he shot. I heard the bullet turn. He broken the both windows, and he missed me here. And then from there, I just came out. The second shooting shot me from here.
Today, Deng Atuay Mawir lives in a secured hotel of a friend that he seldom leaves. But he doesn't want to go in exile. He said South Sudan is his country, and he wants to correct the difficult situation that his people are in. Benno Müchler for VOA News, Juba.
Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission says it's concerned that some of the more than 1.5 million people displaced by 5 years of violence in northern Nigeria, may not be able to vote for president in February. A spokesman says language in the nation's Electoral Act concerning residency must be changed to validate the ballots of those who've been displaced by attacks by Boko Haram and other violence. The election commissioners are distributing registration cards to internally displaced Nigerians who are living in camps and are at other locations. They are also preparing for armed security at election places.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 21 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Ebola continues to attack Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone on several fronts. And Kenya pressured South Sudan's political leaders to agree on a peace deal. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The office of Tanzanian President Jakaya Kikwete has announced the resignation of the country's attorney general. It follows an investigation of alleged corruption by members of the president's cabinet and other senior officials. Attorney General Frederick Werema has denied any wrongdoing. A parliamentary watchdog committee reports money was taken from a $120 million escrow account that was set up to pay an energy firm. It says money went to some government ministers and that Werema allegedly authorized the transaction. Members of the ruling party in parliament have also called for the resignations of Prime Minister Mzengo Pinda, the Minister of Energy and Minerals, and other senior officials. Japan, Britain, the World Bank, the African Development Bank, and eight other donors have withheld an estimated $500 million in loans and grants pending action by the government.
Poor countries lose a lot of money each year from corruption and corporate tax evasion than they receive in foreign aid. A new report calls the losses a structural cause of extreme poverty. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
The nonprofit research organization Global Financial Integrity says developing nations lost $6.6 trillion between 2003 and 2012. Eric LeCompte, head of the Jubilee USA Network, says it's a problem growing by nearly 9.5% each year.
Illicit financial flows refers to the amount of money that leaves countries that's untaxed. In general, that money is anything that ranges from tax evasion to monies that are leaving through corrupt practices. And because of the types of money and because many countries don't have protections in place, countries around the world are losing annually almost $1 trillion due to illicit financial flows.
The GFI report says a record $991 billion was lost to illicit financial flows in 2012 alone. Jubilee USA Network is a coalition of 75 U.S. organizations, 400 faith-based communities, and 50 international partners. It lobbies for global financial reforms to bring debt relief to poor countries. It works with GFI to propose reforms to end illicit financial flows. LeCompte says despite ongoing efforts and statements by G7 and G20 nations, the problem persists.
Around the world, many policymakers and decision makers are still learning about this reality that $1 trillion is leaving countries untaxed. And although there's movement, there still needs to be a lot of education around the issue. And I think for the first time, we're looking at processes where we could actually start to curb this kind of illicit money.
The report compares the illicit outflow of money to the inflow of aid dollars.
The amount of money that is leaving some of the poorest countries in the world is 11 times the amount of aid they receive.
The Jubilee USA executive director says illicit financial flows are making a bad situation worse in Ebola-stricken West Africa.
The three countries that have been affected and hit hardest, Sierra Leone, Guinea, Liberia, currently are losing $1.3 billion a year to illicit financial flows. That dwarfs what is, for these countries, a budget that is less than $300 million to deal with health issues. When this money leaves, it's not addressing some of the important infrastructure concerns in the developing world.
And LeCompte says even some prominent G20 countries are being affected.
In terms of the recent report by Global Financial Integrity, the top five countries around the world losing money to illicit flows between 2003 and 2012 were China, Russia, Mexico, India, and Malaysia.
So if all that money is coming out of the developing world, where is it going?
We don't totally know who is benefiting. We know that it's a whole range of actors.
He says those that could benefit from illicit financial flows include the extraction industries and banks.
Essentially, 80% of all illicit financial flows are caused through a process called trade misinvoicing, where money is sent out, capital is sent out of the country. When materials leave the developing world, they're not being taxed properly for the actual value of cargo that's leaving.
LeCompte says it's a problem that can be solved, for example, by ensuring customs authorities know the true price of goods. GFI estimates it would cost each country a one-time charge of $2 million to establish such a mechanism.
If this process was put in place, it would literally generate billions of dollars for some of the world's poorest economies every year.
Jubilee USA and its partners will push for financial transparency mechanisms at next July's International Conference on Financing for Development in Addis Ababa. They'll also lobby to make them part of the Sustainable Development Goals, which build upon the expiring Millennium Development Goals. If successful, they say, developing countries would have billions of dollars more each year to invest in health, infrastructure, and education. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In news elsewhere, Pakistani officials are taking steps to respond to yesterday's Taliban assault on a school in Peshawar, while the nation begins 3 days of mourning for the 132 children and 9 staff members who died. Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif approved an order today lifting a moratorium on the death penalty in terror cases that had been in place since 2008. Mr. Sharif has also pledged to continue a military offensive against militants in the country's northwestern tribal region near the Afghan border. The Pakistani Taliban said it carried out yesterday's attack in retaliation for the army's push to go after the insurgents. Meanwhile, Pakistani Army Chief General Rahil Sharif and the head of the Inter-Services Intelligence, Rizwan Akhtar, headed to Kabul today to meet with Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and U.S. General John Campbell, who heads NATO forces in Afghanistan. VOA's Ayaz Gul said the visit is unprecedented and could signal a break in what had been improved relations between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, Please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Ebola continues to attack Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone on several fronts. And Kenya pressures South Sudan's political leaders to agree on a peace deal. Coming up, music from Uganda. And in our feature segment, thousands of Maasai gathering in their ancestral lands in Tanzania to discuss the allegations that the government plans to evict them. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Vuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim, and to all our Voice of America listeners.
All right. Well, I understand you have a special guest this evening.
Kim, my special guest on the Sunny Side of Sports is Dr. Larry Azamaje, the founder and chief executive officer of VOA partner Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM in Nigeria. Dr. Larry has stations in Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and Onitsha, and he joins us this evening by telephone from the western U.S. city of Las Vegas, Nevada. How are you doing, Dr. Larry?
Very good. And you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Dr. Larry, before we came on air, I checked the Brilla FM website, and it looks like you've been hanging with some heavy hitters at the World Boxing Council convention. Tell our Brilla listeners and our VOA listeners about that.
Yes, it's been a very, very big party for boxing faithfuls here in Las Vegas as the WBC holds its 52nd convention. 112 current and past champions headlined the event that started it off on Sunday. And Monday evening during the award ceremony, we had superstars like Floyd Moneyman Mayweather Jr., Golovkin, the middleweight champion, Anthony Burrell, the middleweight champion, Golovkin, the super middleweight champion, Steven Behman, the heavyweight champion, Marvin Hagler, Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Hands of Steel, Leon and Michael Spinks, Tommy Hearns, Bone Crusher Smith, Ricky Hatton, Nigel Benn, Joe Calzaghe, Mike Tyson, Evander Holyfield, Sugar Shane Mosley, Riddick Bowe, the one we call Big Daddy. Indeed, big, big stars here. And I won't forget the biggest name from Africa on parade, Azuma Nelson.
Big stars indeed, Dr. Larry. The first name you mentioned was Floyd Mayweather Jr. A lot of talk, Dr. Larry, that Money Mayweather might go against Manny Pacquiao in 2015. What's the general feeling there in Vegas, Dr. Larry, about the possibility of such a mega bout?
It is a fight everyone is talking about. It is a fight everyone wants to see. I had a short chat with Sugar Shane Mosley, and he too underlined that, saying this fight must happen in 2015. Everyone is happy that finally they are calling themselves out. I was ringside for Amir Khan Alexander on Saturday, and I thought Amir Khan advertised himself as a big attraction. But again, Mayweather has said no to Khan because Khan is still not popular, and he's saying it should be Pacquiao. Everyone is saying it should be Mayweather Pacquiao, and I don't think they both will miss this.
Dr. Larry, lots of talk in the media that Mayweather wants a bigger share of the purse than Pacquiao. Do you see money being a hang-up?
Well, I think clearly that Mayweather should have a bigger purse because he's the one who holds the biggest attraction right now. Don't forget that Pacquiao is just coming back from some defeats. And yes, he did very well in his last fight, but Mayweather is still the box office draw. So he should have a bigger one. Money should not be the problem because this is a fight the whole world wants to see. From Mexico through the USA to Africa down to China, this is a fight that I believe will sell out within 1 hour of it being formally announced.
Dr. Larry, another big star you mentioned earlier was Azuma, the Professor Nelson. I know he's been retired for a few years now. What's going on with the professor? How did he look when you met him?
Hale and hearty, in fine shape. And, of course, it was wonderful seeing him again. And Fenech from Australia, you remember there was back then. Azuma is cool. Azuma is trying to help boxing in Africa. Azuma told me that he has a foundation right now in Ghana. And Azuma attended the African Boxing Union Conference, which we had yesterday. He contributed wisely, and he looks good. Fine shape. Great guy. And I won't forget the white beard he carries now.
Dr. Larry, you mentioned that African Boxing Union meeting. Any interesting developments that came out of the meeting of top African boxing officials?
Yes, very many. And first, we must give kudos to the president, Hussein Houachi of Tunisia, and the Secretary General, Celestino Mindra. Both of them indeed show that they mean well for boxing in Africa. And the developments, one, it was clearly stated that regional bodies are not recognized by the ABU, particularly the one parading itself out there in West Africa called the West Africa Boxing Union or even Federation. The ABU said at that meeting, which we all attended, that that body is not recognized. And the president welcomed the new officials following elections in some African countries, Benin Republic, Uganda, Madagascar, and others. The ABU will be having its convention. The last was in 2011. The next will be in 2015. And the venue will be announced officially by the president of the ABU. The ABU is also hoping that doping tests will now be vigorously pursued in alliance with WADA. And that was clearly stated by the president when he was making his opening remarks. There will be zero tolerance for poor conduct by referees and judges. And they want to work for better ratings for African boxers because it's not getting too good now for Africa in boxing. And they also will be doing improved information flow so that everybody will get to know things happening within the ABU. It was a lovely meeting attended by many people, including representatives of the Nigerian Boxing Board of Control.
I'm Manny Pacquiao, the fighter from the Philippines.
Dr. Larry, I'd be remiss if I didn't wish Manny Pacquiao a happy 36th birthday on December 17th as we talk. And I know you said there's a lot of interest in seeing the Pac-Man fight Floyd Mayweather in 2015. Looking back to last month, Dr. Larry, the Pac-Man, very impressive with a unanimous decision victory over Chris Algieri in Macau, China. And now we're all hoping, you're hoping that maybe in his next fight, he'll fight Floyd Mayweather. I got to put you on the spot, Dr. Larry. I love to get predictions from Namdi Moweta, our reigning prince of pugilistics. And I'm going to put you on the spot right now, Dr. Larry. Should the Pac-Man go up against Floyd Mayweather, who do you like in that mega bout?
Well, the world will be entertained, but I'll put my money on Floyd Mayweather.
Why, Dr. Larry?
Because the guy, he said when he was addressing the audience here that all his life he has done nothing else. The only school he has attended is the school of boxing. Everything he has done, he said he watched Roberto Duran fight Leonard as a kid, and he drew inspiration from that and said, this will be my sport. He does the shoulder roll. His defense is wonderful. His arm speed, first grade. Footwork, something you want to praise any day. This is a guy who is sold out on boxing for boxing. And I think, Pacquiao will give him a tough fight. But nobody has the Mayweather code.
Like I always say, for every fight, everybody had a game plan. As of right now, there's not a blueprint on how to beat Floyd Mayweather. No one has found the way to break the Mayweather code.
And I don't think Pacquiao will also find it.
You make it sound, Dr. Larry, that maybe the Pac-Man has maybe too many distractions outside the ring?
Yeah, but once it gets a fight, once it is time to prepare for a bout, he gets it done. And that is the seriousness of a true fighter.
You mentioned Nigerian boxing, Dr. Larry. Can I get your thoughts on one of the top Nigerian heavyweights, Latif Power Kayode? Any news regarding Agbara, Raw Power, Latif Kayode?
No news from the ABU, no news from the WBC concerning him. But I think that clearly what he should do to continue to be up there is to watch what he does in terms of selecting who to fight. That is the problem with so many African fighters. They just go there like Sam Peter did. They don't allow people to guide them. Look at what they are doing now with Deontay Wilder, who is going to fight Beman Stevens on the 17th of January for the World Boxing Council heavyweight title. From 2008 till date, he has chalked up 32-0, carefully guided. They built him up to this point. Look at what Latif did in his last fight. That was very bad. First round knockout. That was not good enough.
Finally, Dr. Larry, I have to extend my heartfelt thanks for a wonderful and memorable trip to Nigeria in October. You were a wonderful host, and your friends and staff at Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM, not just in Lagos, but also in Abuja. And I know you have stations in Kaduna and Onitsha. Just a great trip, Dr. Larry. What's going on with Brilla? Give me an update.
First, we want to thank you, too, for coming. We were really having the sunny side with you, and we hope it will continue. Brilla is doing well. We are hoping to do something new next year. The world is moving to the digital age. And what your mobile phone can do for you in terms of audio and video, we are beginning to look more seriously into. I don't want to make it public now, but I expect that in 2015, people will get to see and hear things from Brilla.
Dr. Larry Izamaje, the founder and chief executive officer of Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM, a partner of the Voice of America with stations in Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and Onitsha, speaking with us this evening from Las Vegas, Nevada. Thank you, Dr. Larry.
Thank you very much, Sonny, and have a great day.
And season's greetings to you and all the Brilla folks.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Dr. Larry Izamaje, he certainly packs some punch on the Brilla airwaves, as well as our VOA airwaves. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. And my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, unpredictable weather wreaking havoc on Rwandan farmers. And next, thousands of Maasai gathering in their ancestral lands in Tanzania to discuss allegations that the government plans to evict them. But first, some music. It is Blue 3 of Uganda with Prisoner.
I'm locked up in solitary and it's fine as long as you're mine.
Uganda's Blue 3 with Prisoner.
Well, unpredictable weather is wreaking havoc on Rwandan farmers. On average, they're losing about 40% of their harvest. It's estimated the losses could cost the agricultural sector $300 million a year by 2030. Farmers are adapting to climate change, as reported by the UN's International Fund for Agricultural Development.
The rain here in eastern Rwanda is almost 3 weeks overdue. But to the relief of farmers, it is finally being forecast. So today, Vice President Odette Mukankiko has rallied together members of her maize cooperative to start sowing. She is hoping the rainy season will finally kick in and their crop will have enough water to grow.
Because of climate change, our yields are lower. And even when it rains, the maize doesn't grow well.
In these rural areas, planting cycles have always been determined by the seasons. But now, Odette says, rain no longer falls when it should, and traditional farming practices are failing.
We used to start drying the maize in the field, but now it's often raining. When we have good yields and no place to dry them, they will spoil after a month.
Farmers can now lose up to 40% of their harvest due to erratic weather. And if the climate change issues are not addressed quickly, it could cost the country's agriculture sector up to $300 million a year by 2030. So the International Fund for Agriculture Development, or IFAD, and the Rwandan government have teamed up to help minimize these losses. It is part of IFAD's Climate Change Adaptation Program for smallholder farmers. Coordinating the project is John Viegasasira.
Farmers also, they have the knowledge, they know. And they have some answers to different problems. What I need is that capacity to react on time before it is too late.
To help build that capacity, farmers' cooperatives are now being equipped with modern facilities where crops can be dried and stored safely, whatever the weather. These centres are also business hubs, linked directly to markets and processing plants where crops are cleaned, processed and stored professionally. Business training is provided so farmers can become market players, capable of delivering large quantities of high-quality produce to both public and private companies. But it is not only crops. Milk production too is being affected by climate change, as Alfred Nisingimana says.
When it rains and we have fodder, we get about 13 liters of milk a day, but we get much less when we have long dry spells.
Rising temperatures are also challenging dairy production. If not kept cool, milk can go off in 2 hours. So now, every morning, farmers take their milk to a hub, this time a milk collecting centre, where it is stored hygienically and refrigerated. Run by cooperatives, members receive steady incomes from sales and have a loan system set up to get through scarce periods. Alfred and Odette are now better prepared for unexpected weather events, and production is improving.
Through maize growing and having access to markets, I started to get more income, and I could afford to get the iron sheets to build this house I'm living in.
This 5-year program aims to provide facilities and know-how to 155,000 more people like Odette, enabling farmers to succeed despite a rapidly changing environment.
That was a report on Rwandan farmers and climate change prepared by the International Fund for Agricultural Development.
Thousands of Maasai are gathering in their ancestral lands in Tanzania to discuss allegations that the government plans to evict them and sell off the land to build a game hunting reserve for rich Arabs. Tanzania's president has dismissed the claims in a post on the social media site Twitter. A global petition against the reported plan attracted more than 2 million signatures. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
As they have done for centuries, Maasai tribesmen graze their goat herds on the vast plain bordering Tanzania's world-famous Serengeti National Park. But Maasai here fear their grazing rights and their right to live on the land are under threat. They claim the government wants to evict 40,000 villagers and turn the plain into a game-hunting reserve run by a safari company based in the Persian Gulf. More than 2 million people from around the globe signed a petition against the proposal on the website of rights group Avaaz. Last week, Tanzania's President Jakaya Kikwete tweeted a message saying, "There has never been, nor will there ever be, any plan by the government of Tanzania to evict the Maasai people from their ancestral land." "That's not true," says Maasai activist Samuel Nangire, who spoke to VOA on a poor phone line from Loliondo in Tanzania, part of the land in question.
"This plan has been there and everybody knows, the world knows."
He says this plan has been there and everybody knows, but the government denied that. So after the president says there has never been a plan and there will not be a plan, the Maasai want to get evidence of that in writing as a commitment from the government. Nangire says the police are trying to disrupt a meeting of around 5,000 Maasai in the disputed region.
"The police have been ordered to go on the ground."
He says the police have been ordered to go on the ground and dismiss the meeting, and no media have been allowed to go there. The Tanzanian High Commission in London did not respond to requests for an interview. Conservationists say it's vital that indigenous groups like the Maasai play a central role in securing remote areas for both people and wildlife. Ian Saunders is a Kenyan conservationist and counterinsurgency expert who has lived in the Maasai tribal areas.
"For any political party to try and relocate a considerably large community like that to another area is not only political disaster, it's also there'll be issues of security."
The Maasai insist they will keep protesting until they receive written confirmation that their ancestral land will not be sold off. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 on UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Yates Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Corruption affects countries around the world. Its forms and impact may vary, but the results are corrosive nonetheless, undermining democracy, stifling economies, thwarting justice, diverting resources, and ruining the futures of nations. The moral and practical costs of corruption are no longer debatable, said Secretary of State John Kerry in a written statement. Corruption drives instability, popular protests, and revolutions. In some cases, these popular movements produce democratic reform, but in other cases, they produce a power vacuum or an authoritarian backlash. Frustration with corruption can also drive insurgency movements and be exploited by terrorist groups to gain popular support. And the proceeds of corruption, which are often sheltered in banks or shell corporations in Western Europe and the United States, enable terrorist financing and sustain unaccountable regimes. And that is why the United States is using every tool at its disposal to advance its anti-corruption agenda. Addressing corruption is tough, but we are using a range of tools and often working with other states and international institutions to encourage and assist anti-corruption activity, said Undersecretary of State for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell. So we are pressing other states to live up to the international anti-corruption commitments they've made. The United States is also enforcing the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and providing some $600 million a year to build the capacity of foreign governments to combat corruption. Still, said Undersecretary Sewell, the biggest factor in the success or failure of anti-corruption efforts is a matter of political will on the part of governments. The willingness to use the power of the law against the biggest violators, regardless of who they are or what political party they support. We renew our notice to kleptocrats around the world. Continued theft from your communities will not be tolerated, and the international community is committed to denying safe haven to you and your illicit assets, wrote Secretary Kerry. We call on partners in government, civil society, and the private sector to join us in fighting corruption. We also call on countries undergoing democratic transition to redouble their efforts to build governments that are accountable to citizens and respect the rule of law.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Dante, AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this, whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.